Welcome to Alive and Kicking, the 90s football podcast, the podcast that's more 90s than knowing the names of the Power Rangers, Tommy, Kimberly, Amy, and the rest. My name's Ash Rose, your host and your guide on this, the original 1990s football podcast, back very quickly as well, because it's summer and we want to fill your footballing void, although, as we talked about on last show, there's not much of a footballing void in 2023, but even so, let's fill it with some 90s goodness for you. Let's fill it with some 90s talk of the summer. And with me, as always, first of all, he's the football tavern. He's the man, he's the landlord, Mr. Ed Chambers. How are you doing, Ed?
Oh, very well, Ashley. Thank you very much. You cocked that intro up, didn't you, by not remembering the name of the Power Rangers, but they're well done.
Well, I don't remember all of them. Well, you know, you've got...
I haven't got a clue.
Yeah, it was always the important ones.
Was it Kimberly there? She was the important one.
She was the important one. Tommy yeah. For the girls, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. But I'm good, mate. How are you?
Yeah, hot again, obviously, in the sweatbox. But no,
yeah.
Our summer episode last time out seemed to go down quite well with the audience, so...
Yeah, I've got a few feedback from a few people, actually, which was quite nice. Yeah, I've sort of... Listening to it back, I sort of worry about myself revealing stories about.
Yeah, we went to some dark corners, didn't we?
Ex-footballers in the bath and bouncing footballs on pavements and stuff. But you know, it was all relevant. So
yeah,
I'm glad people enjoyed it. So yeah.
Yeah, good. And joining us, somebody who we mentioned on that show as well, due to a video that I'm going to ask him about in a second. But if you don't follow him, which I'm sure you do, if you follow us, you definitely follow him. From Stu's Footy Flashbacks, got it out in one go as well. Stuart Steelyard, how you doing, Stu?
I'm very good, Ash. Good to be back. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, it's good to have you back, part of the family here. Let me ask you about, you know what video I'm referring to, 1991 season videos. How long did that take you, that little combination of all the intros? I loved it.
Oh, you mean the Martin Tyler?
Yeah.
welcome to the season 1990-1991. It took a while to find out which ones actually had him, because there's teams like Everton and Liverpool and maybe Arsenal. There's a few others that didn't have him, so it was trying to find out at the 22 which teams used him. And to be fair, the majority did.
Yeah. So did the bigger clubs get somebody special? Because Martin Tyler wasn't quite Martin Tyler at that point, was he?
Yeah, I think they had in-house people. To be fair.
Oh. Yeah.
Although Manchester United used him, I believe, so, you know, it's, yeah.
Yeah,
not too sure why.
I said on the show last week, I remember the QPR one, that is the video I probably watched the most, because it's the first one I ever owned, season review, Roy Wegley on the front, and just, I was waiting, I didn't even skip, I was all waiting along the line, because you even did it in the alphabetical order as well, so you had a slow day, I imagine, that day, Stu.
Yeah, it was, it reminded me of, you know, like when commentators now have to do video games, I imagine you're just repeating the same stuff all the time, so.
No, it was good stuff. Stu, how are you doing yourself? How's the feed going? We know we're big fans of it. The content's great, mate.
Yeah, cheers, mate. Yeah, I've not written as much on my blog as I'd like, because with two young children, it's just ridiculous trying to find the time. I don't want to do it in the middle of the night anymore. it's part of my morning putting up the videos. It's part of my evening trying to find them. My wife sort of got used to it.
Your wife must be incredibly understanding, is all I can say. I mean, you know, I think you're being modest as well. Your page is like incredible. You've got like 35,000 people there. I mean, that's very impressive.
Yeah, I think I take a lot of need the toilet, dear. So I think that's what I do a lot of the time. I don't sit in the front room and just do it in a phase.
Very England themed as well, always your feed. And also you're wearing an England shirt today as well. Obviously you can't see this because it's a visual thing, but for us, Stu is rocking the 91-92 away shirt, I would say.
Well, it's actually Italian 90, right?
Oh, it's Italian 90, is it?
Italian 90,
slightly different, yeah.
But they used it right through until I think the last game was the San Marino 7-1.
Was that the last one? Yeah.
So I'll never get rid of it. I've got the third kit as well, the blue one. So them two are great and joy.
Definitely.
They're both very nice, actually.
And they're proper. Fair. They're not score, draw, retro, remake, are they?
No, no. You can see the Umbro sound.
Yeah, exactly. Love a bit of that. As Ed said before we start recording, I think Stu was wearing it the last time he was on the show. So in our heads, I just think that he just lives in that shirt, which is totally. That's what we all do. We all should. If I could live in my third shirt from 92, the Cowardly Lion shirt, as it's been called in various guises before, that would be... What shirt would you live in, Ed? This is a good question. If you could live in a football shirt... What football shirt would you live in?
Oh, now you've done it.
I know, afraid of that one. That was good. Under the bus, God.
Yeah.
think about it. Tell us at the end of the show.
Yeah.
Think about that one.
I'm going to think about that.
Yeah, you think about that. But anyway, Talking of England, we're doing an England-centric podcast today, and our theme, you may have seen in 2023, we just had the internationals. So I thought we'd continue that theme and also throw in a bit of summer. So what we're talking about today are those kind of unique, because you don't get them anymore because the fixture list is so packed with Nations League and qualifiers. We used to have these friendly tournaments in the 1990s. You know what I'm talking about. So we had the US Cup, we had the Umbro Cup, and then we had Le Tournoi later in the decade, where they were usually, as we'll speak about, kind of almost audition drama, what they call dress rehearsals, that's the term I'm looking for a tournament the following year. They do like a mini version, which is what inconveniently as they did. And England always seemed to be a part of them. So we're going to chat through them, chat through some of the games, the squads, because they're somewhat interesting as well. But as an overview, Stu, I mean, how fondly do you remember these types of tournaments?
I think, like you say, there was in between summers of actual tournaments. So it was just an extra, wasn't it, as an England fan? Just, you know, sometimes when in a little group round robin and stuff like that. And they always seemed to matter. They always took decent squads to them. And like I said, there were dress rehearsals for the major competition the following year. And not only were England in all three of these, Brazil were.
Yeah, they were. I noticed that earlier randomly as well. But I think when you put on a tournament, they're kind of the superstar act, aren't they? They start hiring the Globetrotters. It was trying to get them in. Edward, what do you think? Do you prefer this, or should we stick into Nations League and friendlies and what we have in the modern day? Should they bring back tournaments like these?
I think I'm kind of on the fence with that, Ash, to be honest. I can actually see the purpose of the Nations League. I didn't see the purpose of it to start with. I didn't understand it. And then when I watched I watched a bit of the final last weekend. And, well, a lie, I watched the penalties.
Me too.
And,
exactly.
Yeah, but to see how much losing that meant to Luka Modric, for example, and the Croatian fans, I thought, well, actually, it is quite a strong feeling. Maybe because we don't feel it so much in this country. Maybe that's why. But I do miss these tournaments, though. I think they have this kind of niche kind of look back. As you can say, England attended all three, as did Brazil, like Stu was saying. And, you know, that's we don't have that anymore, really. So I think it's worth looking back, but I wouldn't necessarily bring them back, if that's probably my politician's answer.
Yeah, I was very sitting on the fence. I think I'd bring them back. I'm not okay. Down with them. I mean, we obviously England ballsed up the Nation League this time around, and they got relegated, didn't they? They're in Pot B, whatever that means for them.
Yeah, I mean, I've still not got my head around what that actually. I mean, does that mean England now play Millwall or something? I don't really understand.
It means they can't win it, I think.
Right. Okay.
It means
great.
They can't win it if I remember rightly. Yeah.
They were very close to winning the first one, wasn't they? You know, the inaugural one. So at the time, that seemed quite important. It's like a third tournament behind the World Cup and Euros. But since they've gone off the boiling, I don't think anybody really cares. Yeah.
Is that the one where John Stones decided to keep playing the ball backwards? Was it him and Maguire? And
that's just the one where we lost, wasn't it? That was the middle one.
I seem to remember just
the Hungary. Yeah, the Hungary game.
I think there was one. There was one definitely. It was part of a tournament. It was a series of pass backs.
Well, they got beat by Holland, I think, wasn't it, in that first. Is that what you think?
Yeah, I think it's that. But I think that just goes to show that we don't remember.
Well, I remember Jordan Pickford scoring the penalty, didn't he? Against, was that Switzerland in the sort of third, fourth playoff, I think?
No idea.
Third, fourth playoff, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, let's not talk about Jordan Pickford. Let's talk about the tournaments in the 1990s then, these unique summer tournaments that I loved. So let's talk about those. The starting point is 1993. So we're a year out from USA 94, a year removed from Euro 92. England going to that summer. They have two qualifiers, which I didn't remember actually until I went my research. My timeline wasn't quite in my head, but the famous Norway defeat happens at the end of that season. And then they go into this USA Cup tournament, which involved themselves, Germany, Brazil, and the United States. But do you know what I found really interesting as I was looking through? The squad is quite similar to that of Euro 92, which were a year on at that point. So you'd think there was a bit more scope. But Stu, I think it shows that we were still quite in a transitional era under Graham Taylor, but only Tim Flowers was the only one in there uncapped. It was an interesting squad, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think, like you said, I'd say more than half went to Euro 92. And then you've got people like Paul Ince, who become a staple. Les Ferdinand, I mean, call up, he finally got involved more. And then there's the interesting figures of Earl Barrett and Nigel Winterburn in the squad, which I'm not even sure if they even got much of a game in this whole tournament, but he took them regardless. And Nigel Winterburn, I think that was his like third cap in the space of 7 years, which is very strange of being called. But there was no Stuart Pearce, so I'm assuming it was just a backup, really, because Tommy Dorigo went.
Yeah, I think that was Stu, that was around the time that Pearce had broken his leg. I think I could be wrong, but that was obviously Platt was captain for this tournament. And I mean, as you say, Tim Flowers was, you know, he wasn't necessarily a youngster, Tim Flowers. I mean, I was looking up the squad earlier on, and he was 26 when he got the call up, and then obviously he played for England for a few times after that. But obviously, the David Seaman very much became the number one from here on in. But the summer of 93 was disaster, because as you've already alluded to, sort of the Poland and Norway games, which, you know, for anyone that follows Stu, we obviously know he loves the documentary, and they are two real key points of the documentary, actually. And in fact, in the documentary, they're the points where we actually get to see the players the most. In the Poland and the Norway situation. And coming off the back of that, into this tournament, you got the, maybe I'm wrong, you just get the feeling that the players had had enough by this stage, enough football. They'd been vilified for their performance in Norway, and quite rightly so, but then Taylor sort of hang them out to dry, I think, with the formation and, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And by then, they probably just want to go on holiday. And here they are, practicing for USA 94 in a tournament that, in the back of their minds, are they thinking, are we even going to be there?
Mm-hmm. I think this is a good 2 years planning as well. I'm sure it's about 91 when this little round robin was announced, so they'd have been tied in from then.
Yeah, so but do you think, you know, let's just pick a name off random, you know, Des Walker, right? So Des Walker's got relegated with Nottingham Forest, if I remember rightly, 92-93. Unless he'd gone to Sampdoria by that point.
No, he was at Sampdoria that season.
He was at Sampdoria at that point. Right, okay, I'll take that back. Well, then let's use him again as an example and say Des Walker was with Sampdoria and had, quite frankly, a terrible year at Sampdoria. He probably just wants to not be there. He probably just wants to go, relax, get ready for a new season, and then come back to pre-season ready. And they're out there playing in America. I mean, I don't know what your guys' memories of this tournament are. I don't remember it being on television. Two, I seem to recall finding out the results on GMTV in the mornings, or whatever the equivalent show was at the time. And it was just a grey area, just a dark moment for English football. 93 summer, I just didn't think that this team looked like they were ever going to get to World Cup 94 at all.
I remember watching the Germany game. So I don't know if that was on a particular time. I definitely remember watching the Germany game.
I think Ash, the Brazil and Germany games were like afternoon type in the UK. Yeah. But the USA game was definitely middle of the night job.
Yeah, I just remember that being wake up in the morning, find the result out scenario. Must confess, I have no real recollection of watching the other two games personally.
All three games were live on ITV.
Yeah, Rodney Marsh was commentating on one of them I saw earlier because I was watching some highlights, which tells you how far away, like how long ago that Rodney Marsh was a pundit.
Yeah, well, that's the America link, isn't it?
Yeah, well, totally. Yeah.
Well, and when Alexi Lalas scores in the USA game, he almost cheers.
Right.
He gets very, very excited that he does get quite USA can beat England.
Yeah, I mean, that's the famous game of the three, isn't it? It's the headline the Sun had the next day. It was like Yanks 2, Planks 0. Yeah. It felt like at that point, because, I mean, USA, we were talking about a team there that were full of part-timers. They were obviously preparing for USA 94, trying to get this team together, although they had Roy Wegley, so of course they would have been in England because he's Roy Wegley. And Eric Winalda, Thomas Dooley, Alexis Lass, that kind of era of USA 94. England were kind of expected to roll them over, even in this kind of friendly. And they didn't play well at all. I was watching some highlights earlier. There was a couple of chances for Nigel Clough and stuff, but they really didn't play well at all. They actually played better in the games against Brazil and Germany. So, I mean, that's kind of seen, Stu, isn't it? That USA is kind of one of the key points of the Taylor downfall, isn't it?
It's probably the lowest point, I would say. Obviously, you had the Poland and Norway games, but England had never lost to anybody, I think, probably ranked that low. I mean, USA were pretty much classed as a bit of a joke for a football team at the time. And it was an embarrassing time. I think what Ed was saying earlier about players not wanting to be there, a good example of that is Chris Woods, who had played terribly against Poland and Norway. And then he gets thrown into this USA game, the first one. Makes a mistake for the last goal, tries to punch it, and he jumps above him. And he never played for England again after that. That was his last game, the USA game. So that you could say that almost finished him off, that tournament, when he really didn't need to be there.
Yeah. I mean, it was unfortunate for Woods because, it's his last game, and you had Nigel Martin and Tim Flowers coming through. So it probably would have been his last hurrah anyway. He was coming towards the end of his kind of stint. You'd argue that Flowers and Martin were better goalkeepers than him anyway. But to go out like that was, because he had a funny old England career, really, if you think about it. He was like the in-between guy between Shilton and Seaman, and never really, he did all right at club level. You know, he was quite a decent goalkeeper for Sheffield Wednesday. I always remember that game, I think, when Arsenal beat them 7-1. It was the two England goalkeepers at either end, and that was the big story the next day. Well, that always sticks out on Match of the Day for me. But he
did a lot of waiting, didn't he, Chris Woods? He waited for years behind Shilton, and then it's almost like when it became his time. Like I say, we're all right, but the World Cup qualification, Woods was definitely one of England's worst players.
Yeah, they reckon that the pass-back rule, I've heard that the pass-back rule might have done for Woods because he wasn't as good with his feet. You look at the keepers now, your Allisons and your Edisons and stuff, they always play centre midfields. You know, the way the range of passing that they've got, I'm not sure if Woods is on that, anywhere near that level. But just going back to the USA game for a minute, I mean, Ash, you said the headline that was in the newspaper. I mean, up until that point, pretty much the most embarrassing defeat that England had in their existence was in 1950, losing 1-0 to 1-0 to USA. And here we are, 43 years later, losing 2-0, and the press tried to dress it up and view it in the same way. I wouldn't necessarily say the two were the same. You know, the US had obviously moved on a bit in terms of the way they play football, but also with it being this sort of pre-season tournament that nobody really wanted to be at. From an England perspective, I'm not sure the same amount of energy and effort was given, but it is interesting that, you know, that's the way. I mean, the press were already after Taylor at that stage, or they already had him with the turnip stuff. And then to lose to America was just what it was. I think they loved it, really, to be honest.
Yeah, it was a time when they were at him, weren't they? It was another excuse to get him. Just tying up a bow on the other results. So England played Brazil. It was a 1-1 draw. David Platt scored in that game, assisted by Andy Sinton, those who put him in England's worst ever team. But a lovely assist from Andy Sinton then. And then in the final game, it was Germany 2, England 1, and David Platt scored again. This is your 5-minute scorn, Stu. David Platt was still the man then for England, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he was injured for the USA game. I don't think, because Paul Ince captained England that game. Notably being the first black England captains, I remember. He only came on a sub in the Brazil game at half time as well. Scored straight away, and then he started the Germany team game. So I'm assuming he was injured. I can't actually remember what the reason for that was. But the Platt goal in the Germany game, I'll put it on my Twitter the other day, it's a really, really good goal between Ince, Barnes, and Platt, like just triangle passing through the Germany defence. It's almost like that goal is bad saying. It's like a highlight of Taylor's career, really, as England manager, because they tore open the world champions for a minute.
Yeah, no, it's a great goal. There's also, I meant to say about the USA game, there's a shot from Merson, I think you put on your Twitter feed, that I saw earlier today as well. If that had gone in, it's one of the greatest England goals I think I've ever seen. Sort of flicks it up with one leg, then goes for the volley. And it's a great save by, I think it's our old friend Tony Miola in goal for the USA. But yeah, but that is it's another great goal. And then Platt gets I think it's a header, isn't it, against... No, that's the Brazil goal. And then the Germany goal, which is the consolation. Stefan Effenberg and Jürgen Klinsmann get on the score sheet for them, who win the tournament. They played three, two games drawn, one defeated, and topped the group on 7 points to Brazil, USA, and then England with their sorely point bottom of the league.
See, I... I do actually seem to recall watching the Germany game now that we've now that you said the German goal scorers for some reason, I seem to have that sort of triggered a memory. I just want to bring you back a point though, Ash. You said about the worst ever England team included Andy Tinton. Now, I didn't know that.
No, well, you get a lot of these charts, like a lot of these kind of Sky One shows going, the worst England team ever. Andy Tinton always seems to get in that conversation.
I like the way you threw in that he had an assist in a tournament that we've already declared that nobody gave a monkey's about. So you're now expecting everybody that's ever written Andy Sinton's name down in a worst ever England team to cross it out due to the assist.
Yeah, I'm sure there's players that have never had an assist on their record. And
an assist is an assist.
Assist is an assist in an international show.
Fair enough.
And played at a major tournament as well. Add that to his tick list.
Yeah, Ash, I'm right behind you on that stuff. Same with Carlton Palmer. I don't know why he gets mentioned in the worst ever, because he's not. They were good
players. I actually agree with that. And funnily enough, just winding Ash up being the QPR fan, Andy Sinton, I don't even know where that comes from. There is I did something on the Football Tavern the other day saying just name a random England player. Some of the names that came up, I didn't even know had played for England.
Like Jay Boothroyd.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, what's this? Who was the other one? Fraser Campbell.
Fraser Campbell, yeah.
When did Fraser Campbell play for England?
Capello went a bit mad, didn't he?
Yeah, it was around that era, but I had no recollection of him playing for England. So there is no way in the world Andy Sinton should be in a team like that.
I think the Andy Sinton point is always, unless you're a QPR fan or, like you, Ed, have known a QPR fan pretty much your whole life, Andy Sinton's one of those players you kind of go, oh, Andy Sinton. Or like Stu, who knows his stuff. But I think if like people just kind of don't remember him, and then they go, oh, he played for England? It's kind of, you know, I'm sure there's an equivalent of someone who played for, I don't know, Leeds. I'll go, oh, yeah, because he's not in my consciousness as much as Andy Sinton. I mean, he's club ambassador as well. So he does the podcast. He's all over QPR in 2023. So he's very much in the psyche. But we talked about Andy Sinton. We talked about David Platt. Didn't think that was going to happen.
Well, it's not over yet.
It's not. But I was going to say, before we move on, anything else, Stu, you want to mention about the USA Cup from 1993?
No, there's also no Gascoigne there as well.
Yeah, I think he was injured, wasn't he? Yeah.
Well, I know, but he did play in the Poland and Norway games, didn't he? So, I'm sure. I wonder whether he just asked to be out of that, because he was definitely not on form. And I don't think there's any other players that were in those two games that didn't go to that tournament. He did well to get out of it if he did.
Perhaps they left Gascoigne behind because they were just in fear of him being arrested and never leaving America.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that. I've heard Paul Merson talk about this trip where he apparently they were just on the booze all the time.
What a shock.
I know, exactly. And one night they told, because the FBI came to the England hotel and said, they're in Washington, and said, do not go out at night. This is the murder capital of the world. And Merson just got hammered and went out on his own and started breaking up fights. And the next morning, the FBI found out about it and had to come and sort of reprimand him and say, look, you cannot go out. We mean it.
Paul Merson. Paul Merson in the 90s.
What more can we say about that man?
Let's move on to, we're going mid-90s now. So this is 1995 summer, June 1995. This was a tournament called the Umbro Cup. So all the teams in it, I believe, yeah, of course they were, all had Umbro kits. So that kind of tied in nicely, including Brazil, who had the stunning, still wearing that stunning Umbro set from USA 94, as well as Japan, which I always think is such a random team in this tournament, but also very interesting, and Sweden as well. We're getting a bit more now, aren't we? This is a really interesting squad. I love this squad because it's a real mix of what we would see at Euro 96, a lot of the names that you see, but there's also some really random, there's some Andy Sintons in here for everybody else, because there are 5 uncapped players in the squad. So you had John Scales, who was at Liverpool at the time. Dan Collymore got his first call up after, you know, a great season at Nottingham Forest. It was Gary Neville's first call up. Colin Cooper gets in the England squad, and it becomes David Unsworth's only England squad and only England appearance during the tournament. Ed, coming to you, I mean, that's, if there's a more mid-90s England squad, I like to call this the Corinthian figure squad, because I swear that most of these had Corinthian figures. It kind of, we're in that kind of era, aren't we?
Absolutely, yeah, and yeah. I mean, you've mentioned the Colin Cooper aspect. I mean, that is a, you know, that is a name. You think Colin Cooper play for England? You think,
yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, we started the Brazil game, which I appreciate wasn't the first game, but we started with Scales and Cooper as the centre backs, and they were marking some bloke called Ronaldo or some kid called Ronaldo who was only about 18, 19 at the time. So yeah, I mean, one memory I do have of this actually, and it's something you will never get now, is for the Japan game, which was I think was the first game out of the three. I was at some sort of family event, you know, sort of barbecue or whatever, and so we couldn't get to see the game. And you don't get this anymore. We actually managed to avoid the score.
Wow.
Yeah. So can you imagine that now with the notifications you get on your apps, and you go on Twitter and everyone's talking about it, and it's all over the news and whatever. We managed to avoid it then to watch Match of the Day. And of course, Japan were just, I thought they were going to be basically the Far East version of San Marino. I was like, yeah, Can't wait to see this goal fest. And England were awful.
Yeah, it was a bad game.
It was a bad game all round, and it scraped a 2-1 win. And it just wasn't what I mean. Having avoided the score all day, I kind of wish that I just found out and not bothered watching it. But you know, it was a poor game. And yeah, I hadn't realised too earlier on that that was Gary Neville's debut.
Yeah.
I thought he'd played a little bit earlier than that, but he hadn't. So he was just coming into his own. And then obviously, of course, he became an important member of Euro 96.
Yeah, well, it was Neville, Scarrels, Unsworth and Collymore. They all made their debut in that first game, which I was at. It was my birthday treat, the Japan game, 1995.
Very good.
So that would have been my 11th birthday. 12th birthday? God, I can't do maths. So, yeah, I went to Wembley with a few friends and my mum and dad, I believe. My dad was definitely there. Mum was not a footballer. I can't remember if my mum was there. My dad was definitely there. And, I remember being really excited about it. I'd been to Wembley for a few years for an England game. Like you, thinking we were going to roll over this Japan side, hoping for a few goals. Collymore was playing. He was the kind
yeah.
of, he was the big talk, you know, strikers. Shearer as well. Him up front with Shearer was kind of frightening to think Shearer and Collymore up front together. And yeah, it was a horrible game. I remember it being a really boring game. Darren Anton scored with a bit of a deflection, and then it was a penalty from you-know-who, David Platt. So yeah, it wasn't a great opener. Stu, what are your memories from at least the opener of the Umbro Cup?
My first memory is Stan Collymore in the number 6.
Yeah, of course he
which
did.
Who did those squad numbers? Wow. I mean, John Barnes is 10. You could just swap them around for me.
It
looks horrible when you look at...
Because they've got no names, have they? I remember they had no names, but they had numbers. Yeah.
So, and apart from that, I mean, yeah, it was coming for the hour, coming for the man, really, wasn't it? With Platt.
You don't get that with Andy Sinton, do you?
No, you don't. No, definitely not. No.
No, it definitely wasn't. It wasn't. But like you, I mean, when we were younger, when England played a lesser team, it was all about, oh, we're going to get some goals now. Mm. And that wasn't really exciting. But yeah, it was a bit of an anticlimax. They got the win, I suppose. And yeah, like you said, there's three of those debutants, you said, in the squad, Scales, Unsworth and Cooper. It's not often you get debutants at centre half, is it?
Yeah.
You know, especially like I think Pallister was the other centre half that went. But two of the games, you've got two debutants, you know, or two very inexperienced centre halves partnering each other. Which yeah, you wouldn't see that often these days. But he was obviously trying things out, wasn't he? I'm sure he had some pullouts. As I recall, Paul Ince pulled out, and Venables fell out with him. Because Ince was a witness for the Cantona trial.
And
it was around that time, and also he was getting a move to Inter Milan, and he says I can't be doing with it. So and Venables didn't pick him again until the following April, so he left him out for quite a long time, which he just got him out just before Euro 96, really.
Mm-hmm. Played so, a key role as well. Imagine that, we wouldn't have Ince. He was a key member of that Euro 96.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
I was just going back to that as well, the point about the debutants. I mean, I sort of jokingly said about Cooper and Scales starting against Brazil. I mean, that is a real test, isn't it? You're up against the best team in the world, but not only are you up against the best team in the world, you're up against the fact that they're chucking in the young kid Ronaldo and Janinho, who absolutely tore us apart. But also, you're going into that game with Cooper and Scales at centre-half and Gary Neville at right-back. Mm. Yeah. So three of the back four, Stuart Pearce was the other one, the left-back. They played 4-4-2 in this game. And you're going, how to start three of those, that is a real baptism of fire. You either, it's a sink or swim moment, isn't it, to be honest. And that's where Brazil just absolutely tore us to shreds after we'd originally gone 1-0 up.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that goal in a minute. But I think the game everyone kind of remembers the Sweden game, the one at Ellen Road midweek.
Yeah.
And what everyone remembers is the Darren Hansen goal. This game was everything the Japan game was. And he had goals, he had great goals. It was more of a, you know, two in and fro in from each team. Sweden, one of England's nemesis. We never always seemed to play them, never seemed to beat them, in terms, even in whatever decade we're in. But that Darren Hansen goal, Ed, when it hits both posts and goes in, it's one of those kind of highlight reel goals, isn't it?
Oh, without doubt. It's one of those. I think it's the reason a lot of people will remember the Umbro Cup full stop, to be honest. It's the double ping off the post. I think one thing I remember about that, I'm now just trying to do it off the top of my head, but I think it's very rare I don't think I'd seen England play outside of Wembley before then.
Oh, yeah.
And then because it's quite common now. I mean, obviously, they've, you know, done it very recently, but it's quite common now, especially after, you know, the original Wembley was torn down. But, yeah, they played the game at Ellen Road. But, you know, I mean, the Anderson goal and all that, it kind of masks the fact that England were 2-0 down quite quickly. Yeah. And then Sheringham obviously got them back into it just before half-time. But, yeah, to be 3-1 down with 4 minutes to go and draw 3-3 is not, you know, it's not too bad of an outcome in the end. But yeah, it was definitely, I mean, as a spectator, it was far more interesting than the Japan game.
Who scored the other goals, Stu? Who scored the other goal?
Sheringham, Platt and Anderton scored.
Oh, no. David Platt again.
David Platt,
what a hero.
Just like you said, Ed, there, imagine if England lose that game 3-1.
Yeah.
That's really bad for Venables and for the team.
Yeah.
Even though it's a friendly tournament. But it's all about the ending that match. Yeah. Platt gets a header. You're thinking hello, and then yeah. No, I don't think anybody had seen a goal like that. We had at both posts. I don't think I certainly haven't before. That you couldn't believe what you'd quite seen.
Yeah,
Les Ferdinand scored a goal for KPR that hit both posts. But I think that may have been just after it, or maybe just before. Not like Anderson's was a better goal because it was more of a long ranger. Anderson's Les Ferdinand kind of hit from an angle and it kind of rolled along the goal line. This kind of proper like pinballed ping, didn't it, in the goal?
It was absolutely extraordinary. But I mean, it was a good game. I remember Sweden scored. I think Sweden scored a couple of good goals as well, actually, which kind of which obviously kind of adds to the excitement of it all, I suppose. But yeah, as Stu was saying, I mean, in terms of how it was for England to be 3-1 down at home to Sweden, if they lose that game 3-1 to Sweden, you've got 2 years of crap friendlies, essentially, and then an Umbro tournament where you're being beaten by Sweden and an absolutely torn apart by Brazil. It really does dampen the expectation for the following summer, which is no bad thing, absolutely, as we found out at the time. Mm. But you know, I think it was a good test because Sweden were, I mean, let's not paint Sweden as some sort of middle of the road team, which they may be now. They were coming off the back of being what, third in USA 94. Yeah. They had some exceptional players in that team.
Yeah,
I don't think they qualified for Euro 96, though, did they?
Yeah, but then it was, I suppose, harder to qualify for the Euros than it is now.
Now, I mean, if you don't, it's harder not to qualify for the
year. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I mean, you are right. They didn't qualify, but they were still a good side. So I think we shouldn't sort of overlook that. But So essentially, if it wasn't for the Anderton double ping, it could have been a very, very different story.
Well, this was
Ed. I've got a fact for you, Ed. Sorry, you know, you're about the England fixtures away from Wembley.
Go on.
That was England's first home fixture away from Wembley Stadium since England played Poland at Goodison Park in 1966.
There you go.
On the money.
Definitely, Definitely not in my lifetime. So that was the first time I've seen England play.
That's a long time. Yeah, didn't realize it was that. Yeah, I didn't know that. Good fact. Well, this was obviously also a prelude to Euro 96 as well, because they went around the grounds. That was at Elland Road. Then you had Brazil beating Sweden at Villa Park.
What other games was played at Goodison? I'm sure.
Yeah, Japan. Japan, Brazil was at Goodison.
But Goodison wasn't part of the Euro 96.
No, so I don't know why that... Yeah, there's surely there's a story there. The City
City Ground was another one, yeah.
Yeah, that hosted Sweden, and the 2-2 draw between Sweden and Japan, where Kenneth Anderson scored twice to become tournament's top scorer. But you mentioned that Brazil game as well. I kind of think that's remembered for, obviously, Ronaldo, because that he was still a young guy coming in. The Juninho factor, because that's, as Joel, friend of the show, will testify to, that's where Brian Robson first come across Juninho. That's kind of that set that ball rolling in terms of where he eventually end up on Teesside. It was remembered for that Graham Lasso opener, which is one of these, a proper worldie as well, from a corner, comes out, chests it and then volleys it back in. England's red current kit, one of the nice underrated kits of the decade. Stu, what are your memories for the Brazil game? Where, I mean, Brazil were very, very good, weren't they?
They were, but it took a while for them to get going. There, when Lasso scored, it was, you were like, "Wow, we're beating Brazil!" And it was a really, really good goal. I think it got voted something like 12th best England goal. I saw in one of those silly polls.
Yeah,
the do. But it was a great goal. And then the second half, Brazil really did turn it off. And that's when Juninho was there as well, wasn't he? With the, I think he was at Middlesbrough by then, wasn't he? I think.
No, this was upset. Just before. This is where Brian Robson tapped him up, I believe.
Yeah.
Because he was
That's right.
Sao Paulo. Yeah, I think he was out. Yeah.
Yeah, because he scored a free kick, didn't he, to equalise. It was, well, that is the word I was going to use, actually. It really was cheeky, because I think they were expecting a sort of a rocket from Roberto Carlos or something different, and suddenly Juninho just clips it over the wall and it's in the back of the net. And then, of course, we've talked about the defence already, but defence splitting ball, maybe it's not as difficult to split Scales and Cooper, but I mean, who were decent players in their own right. I'm making them sound like they were terrible, but slips the ball through and Ronaldo does the rest. So Juninho, that was the first time we'd ever seen Juninho. And then, to our amazement, 4 or 5 months later, there he is turning up at newly promoted Middlesbrough. You're not going to get that so much today, No. First of all, I think everybody and his wife would have heard of Juninho before this game because of the way, you know, things have evolved. But also, I think in the pecking order, the big boys would have just come straight in and take a player like Juninho.
I think Brian Robson was on the coaching staff, wasn't he, for England? So I'm assuming these from then on.
Yeah.
He had him in his mind, I think Arsenal were in for him. I think it's the fact that Brian Robson went to Brazil to meet him.
Yes, yeah, it was, yeah.
And that swayed Juninho into signing for Middlesbrough, which is obviously a big Premier League moment. I always remember that shot at the end as well, where the Brazil got the trophy looked like, but they're wearing the England kit. So there's that famous shot of like a 19-year-old Ronaldo in the England kit, and you get those kind of like the best player to ever wear an England kit memes on Twitter, don't you? And it's Ronaldo from 1995. But
just on that Juninho point, just going back quickly, if he'd have gone to Arsenal in 95, they'd have had him, Bergkamp and Platt all in one summer.
Yeah, that'd have been all right, wouldn't it?
Oh, you're not wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, Bruce Rioch in charge.
With Bruce. Yeah, exactly.
Stu Houston is his number two.
Yeah.
What happened to them in a couple of seasons' time, mate?
Like everyone, they went to the graveyard shift of QPR. So
that was a bad move, wasn't it? I mean, I've got good memories of the Umbro Cup. It was kind of that. I think that's my fondest of the three, because I think obviously I went to a game. It's really mid 90s. It had that kind of debut aspect to it. Brazil were at their shiniest best in that kit. I've got fond memories of
it. It got you in the mood for Euro 96, didn't it?
That's totally.
It did its purpose.
Yeah. From our point of view as well, you know, we're all roughly about the same age, I think, sort of, you know, and we were sort of 12 or 13 at the time of this tournament. And I think this is the last tournament where we perhaps didn't know some of the players before they turned up, because as we're moving into our teens, we're moving into the sort of gaming era. You're moving into your FIFAs and your championship managers and the manager games, and things were evolving, sort of segueing into the tournoi here a bit. But with Roberto Carlos, I remember that there was a 4-4-2. I think it was either 4-4-2 and 90 Minutes article about Roberto Carlos, and you know how that he was playing for, you know, at this time of the article, he was playing for Inter Milan, and they were talking about how this guy had thighs the size of like tree trunks and stuff like that. It was like, all right, he's that guy. So we'd heard of Roberto Carlos, and I think as we got to Le Tournoi, you looked at the French team and the you know the Brazilian team or whatever, and you thought you know all of the players. Whereas going back to Janinho, I didn't know who Janinho was before the Umbro Cup.
Yeah, I think it wasn't just computer games as well. Though. I think like we were exposed so much more. I think memorabilia and everything just went on another level with France 98 because you had sticker books upon sticker books, card collections, you know, Teabag were doing their own, like PG Tips would do some sort of card thing. There was photo, like there was so much more. Newspaper supplements became a thing by 98 where you'd have pullouts and everything. It became much more exposed, I think. And I mean, this was obviously a precursor to France 98, Le Tournoi. I always feel like this was a tournament that had a bit more, because of the four teams involved, like no disrespect to like there was no Japan, there wasn't a USA, although they beat England. But like England, Brazil, France, and Italy, Stu, it was a meaty tournament, wasn't it? They were like, we was like, if we're ready for France, not yet. I mean, we were playing Italy in our qualifying group as well, which always finds
quite. Yeah, I think that's what I remember the most is in like, well, Italy have just beaten us.
Yeah.
And then there's the host France, and then there's the world champions Brazil. This is quite the task. But the first game, I mean, they bashed Italy.
Yeah. It's one of those England performances. Like I think because it's in a friendly tournament, I don't think it gets enough credit. Like, England were great that night, like, and they scored two great goals. The pass from Paul Scholes is for Ian Wright. It's one of the best you'll see of that era. It's a proper.
It's delicious. That's the
delicious
word.
Delicious is a great word.
Yeah, that's delicious.
And his finish as well for the second goal, like that is a proper ball spanked into the net as well. It's a great performance, you know. And it's as you say, Stuart, off the back of that defeat with Zola beat Ian Walker at Wembley before the night in Turin where we'd qualify, but to kind of dispatch of Italy quite so comfortably was. Gave England a lot of hope, didn't it, Stu?
Yeah, and also, the one thing I do remember about this game, I put this up on my Twitter the other week. It's around the time when there was the last of the proper old-school tackle and Stuart Pearce goes through Roberto Di Matteo, wins the ball, takes his legs, takes everything, and Di Matteo has to go off injured, and they just carry on playing. And yeah, it's just complete different times.
But
I couldn't believe there wasn't more of a fuss made of it when I've seen it since. They just roll him off the pitch.
Yeah,
I think in that game as well that Ian Wright. My memory of this game seems to be that Ian Wright absolutely terrorised the Italian defence.
Yeah,
and who does that? You know, not many people would give Paolo Maldini a nightmare. Mm. And I think Ian Wright was on top form in that game, and it came up as you were saying, it came off the back of losing at Wembley, which was a big defeat in terms of, not in terms of scoreline, but in terms of, you know, in how it impacted the group. But it gave real hope that thinking, hello, we're going to play these again in October. We can match these.
Looking at the squad, in terms of looking towards France 98, I'm trying to think, there's only a few names that didn't make that eventual squad. Like John Scales has somehow survived.
Again.
Yeah, John Scales somehow survived.
Was he in Le Tournoi as well? Was he? I don't remember that.
Ed, do you know who else was a Le Tournoi that Glenn Hoddle doesn't bloody remember?
Oh, I thought you were going to say Andy Sinton. Lee Clark.
Lee Clark.
Yeah, just to give a bit of context for that, for anybody that's missed Glenn Hoddle. Ash mentioned this in an interview. We interviewed Glenn Hoddle, and Ash said, oh, you took Lee Clark to Le Tournoi, and basically Hoddle was like, no, I didn't. And we were like, you didn't. Yeah, but we can't say that. You know, you're Glenn Hoddle. You know, to this godlike figure. But Lee Clark was the, Lee Clark.
He didn't play. He didn't even get a game either.
He didn't play.
No, he
wasn't there. So Scales wasn't there. Lee Clark, Ian Wright didn't go to France 98, of course. Andy Cole didn't go. Obviously Gazza. But apart from that, it's pretty much Phil Neville. Sorry, he's there. It's pretty much the squad as well. He would go to France a year later, and you know what happened. But it gave us kind of an idea of what to expect. So we had the Italy game, then we beat France, which was a bit of a scrappy game and a bit of a scrappy winner as well with Alan Shearer's. That looked like it was going to a draw, but that again, to beat them, it was kind of like we haven't played very well, but we've actually beaten France now. And then the Brazil game was a bit non-eventful because they ended up probably lucky to get away with that one. But then we won a trophy. Like, we actually won a trophy. Yeah. And Stu, is there a more miserable looking person holding a trophy in football history than Alan Shearer when he holds up that, what was it, plastic football and some sort of...
Yeah, he looks embarrassed, doesn't he? And also, if you notice that they're stood on where everybody's hands are, in the front row. So he has to bend down to pick up this awful trophy. I think he'd rather just took a medal and you know, not have to go up. It was like you're walking up the 39 steps of Wembley just for that. England won that after the France game, didn't they, as I remember? Yeah. They tied it up with a game to go.
Yeah.
I wonder where that trophy is now. Like, where's the World Trophy?
Is it in anyone's garage?
Yeah.
Does anyone know?
We should start a campaign to find the Latunois trophy
I'd say a car boot sale was a very 90s thing. It's probably in someone's garage. But do you know what? It's probably in the National Football Museum or something like that. Someone will know. I mean, Latunois, for an England fan, is a bit like the ZDS Cup for a Crystal Palace fan. It's like the only trophy that we can hold on to, isn't it? It's like, we've won Le Tournoi. No one can ever take that away from us.
No. I know. The Le Tournament, obviously, as it's translated to. But yes. I mean, Shearer is obviously not someone who's going to be chatted about that. I mean, he didn't win much in his career as well, but he didn't seem to. I don't think they went out on the piss that night, did they? Celebrating the win.
Well, they probably did, just regardless. But... But actually, you know, Stu was saying about Pierce's tackle on Di Matteo, but I mean, Di Matteo, of course, of Chelsea, which I suppose goes back to my point about knowing more of the players, in the fact that there was more foreign players coming over to our shores as well. So they were playing for the big international sides. I seem to recall the Brazil game was a bit of a, it was obviously a dead rubber because the tournament was over. Yeah. Did Romario score in that game?
Yeah, he scored the winner. Yeah.
Yeah. I just seemed, it was almost like in my head, that's like the last time I saw Romario. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't remember.
Would have been for us for sure, because he wasn't around come 2002, was he? So.
Yeah, he was at France 98 though, wasn't he? I think
he was in the squad. Yeah, I mean, I would have to go back and have a look.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just the last time I sort of remember seeing Romario. But yeah, do we look at that as being a good tournament because England won, and we look at USA won as being just a load of old nonsense because we were so bad, or was Le Tournoi more enjoyable as a whole?
I think it's both.
I think the quality of teams, like those, as I said, those three teams made it feel bigger, didn't it? It took it up a level. And I think what you said earlier about France 98 becoming more of a thing for everyone, everyone went a bit crazy. I think the anticipation for that made it feel bigger as well. He didn't go, actually. I'm looking at Romario, the France 98 squad. He didn't make the France 98
squad. Oh, did he not?
No.
Was he not injured and then they called up Bebeto?
Maybe, yeah, that rings a bell a bit. Someone will tell us. Yeah, there's not often we don't remember something, but yeah.
There's always someone will know.
Yeah, but I think, yeah, Le Tournoi, it almost feels like the USA one was big for maybe USA, and I think Graham Taylor was already kind of on the, you know, things were already very much going pear-shaped for Graham Taylor, and that was kind of just another cog in what was happening. The middle tournament feels like, as I said earlier, kind of the fun of the mid-90s, like these names and the colour and the kits and everything, whereas Le Tournoi felt a bit serious. Like, it felt like it was more of a tournament more than the others. It felt like it meant something, maybe because we won it, maybe because we got a trophy, but I don't know. I don't know about you, Stu. I think there's a more kind of serious stigma to Le Tournoi.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the games went nice as well, which makes it seem more business-like. But I mean, I'm just looking there at like the opposition. I was just looking at Brazil's team. It's incredible. And I know England won, but that's exactly what you're about the standard of opposition in this competition. I mean, Brazil's team, Taffarel, Cafu, Aldair, Silva, Flavio Conceição, Roberto Carlos, Danilson, Dunga, Ronaldo, Leonardo and Romario.
Oh, that's not bad at all, is it?
No, it's not bad. Yeah.
Not bad at all.
There's a team that would go pretty much close to winning France 98, wouldn't it, really? Because two of these teams contested the final a year later, which is what this tournament was a warm-up for. So, I mean...
I don't think we can talk about Le Tournoi without actually talking about the free kick.
Yeah, that's finishing. It's something we've talked about on this show before, but it's probably one of the most played free kicks in history, isn't it?
How many free kicks can you remember was shown as a news item on BBC One at 6 o'clock as being, how did this actually happen? So it wasn't even part of a report of the game. Yeah. It was actually, how the hell has he done this? Because it bends so far out and then comes back in again that we hadn't really seen anything like that before.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
When you see that ball boy move his head.
Yeah. And absolutely incredible. I mean,
Carlos
because...
tried it again for the next 10 years, every time he took up for a free kick, you were going, go on then, try again. Yeah. I don't think he ever quite repeated it. I don't know if he did it in training.
But just, I think people got a bit annoyed with it as time goes on because it's like, oh, right, the free kick. But it's so, so good. You know, it's shown a lot because of how good it is.
Yeah,
that's the reason why. You know, and that's the reason why people get frustrated with it, because they see it all the time. But it is absolutely incredible.
It's almost like a camera trick, isn't it? The way the ball goes so far wide of the post, then just almost like a cartoon swings back in. One of the greatest non-competitive goals we've seen, probably, not in a major tournament. Yeah. When you think about it, obviously we don't watch every friendly and every kind of other tournament, but that's definitely one that stands out most famously, isn't it? What do you reckon, Stu?
Yeah, I think memorable wise, it's got to be up there. I don't know about great. I mean, it's, at the time, from the camera angle that you see for the match, I can remember it going, hitting the post going in, but the commentator went mad.
Yeah,
as in, like, because we didn't see that angle until the replay. So when you saw that replay angle, like I said, where that ball boy looks like he's going to hit him in the face and he moves and then it bends back in. Yeah, it's you don't see them sort of things. Right? Very sensible soccer-esque.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, very good memory. I'm going to finish by asking both of you. So of the three, Stu, coming to you first, what's your favourite? The David Platt element makes me think you're going to pick the US Cup. But what was your favourite of the three?
Well, Platt scored two in two of them.
Can't go anywhere.
I would agree with you, Ash. I think Latoma is the best. Just the simple fact that they're all good teams, good squads, everything. I mean, you know, you forget that England had John Scales and Lee Clark in there. but the standard of football and teams in that tournament, I would definitely say Latoma.
Ed, are you agreeing?
Yes, I am agreeing. I think from a standard of, you know, from a quality standard, Le Tournoi is the best. From a nostalgic perspective, you might pick the Umbro Cup, but in terms of listing them in a three, I would actually do it in reverse order. I'd say Le Tournoi.
Yeah, definitely.
There was also, by the way, there's 4 years that span these squads, 93 to 97. There's only three players that went to all three.
Oh God, I haven't even noticed that. So one was not Platt. He would have been Tim Flowers.
Yeah,
Tim Flowers would have been one. It's going to take too much audio. Who have you got, Stu?
David Batty,
yeah.
And Teddy Sheringham.
Teddy Sheringham just made his debut, didn't he? Just before the US Cup. So Wow.
Knowledge.
That's the difference good. In squads though is massive. Just over four years.
That's the turnaround England players. And he's gone from as well, like you think of someone in that first squad, like Earl Barrett to Colin Cooper, like the difference in eras of Premier League is and First Division is really
vast.
Different to Lee Clark, who, you know, did Lee Clark have that good of a season? I don't even remember him having that good of a season.
He was at
Newcastle.
He moved to Sunderland that summer, I think.
He moved, yeah, sorry, you're yeah. right, it's 97, isn't it? Yeah. He moved to Sunderland, which was a drop down a league, so...
Interesting. If I ever speak to Glenn Hoddle again, I'll ask him.
but he'll have no memory of Lee Clark whatsoever.
I prefer the Umbro Cup in terms of, because I'll always go for the nostalgic value, because I like that kind of quirk to it, and I think also, I really thought Stan Collymore was going to be... Like, obviously, we had the SAS coming. We didn't know quite the SAS would be at that point, but I loved Stan Collymore. I thought he was brilliant, and I was so excited for him. England, obviously, it never worked out, and that's where it was could have started, at the Umbro Cup against Japan. So I would definitely go that. Ed, we asked you at the top of the show if you could live in any shirt for the rest of your life. Did you think of one?
I did. I am going to go for the Brazil shirt from USA 94, which is the blue one. Is that the game where Bebeto does the baby thing?
That's a top three kit for me.
I've there was two kits that popped into my head. That one, and for some reason, the Lazio one that Gascoigne sort of wore. I do like a bit of that. But yeah, that Brazil kit came to mind. So I've gone for that.
Yeah, other than the England kit and obviously the USA 94 kit, I think that'd be my next one written down. All big, apart from the USA kit, all big collars. We're all fans of the polo collar on here, aren't we? I think that's a proper kit, that is definitely for sure. Stu, thank you very much as always, mate. Anything we've missed? You've thrown a good facts on there, but I think we've covered pretty much anything David Platt did that we didn't talk about.
I've got all my printouts in front of me. Everything's been covered.
Everything's been covered. If people don't follow you, and they damn well should, where can they follow you on the social?
They can follow me on Twitter at Stu's Footy Flash. Every morning there's something fresh. Something in the afternoon if I've got something.
Is number one for me in terms of if you want to find something quirky that you haven't seen, rather than happy birthday too, which is what normally you get.
Well, that's what I try to do. I don't like to just go. Everybody's seen great goals, haven't they? You want to see something a bit more niche that you can't remember, or something ringing a bell. So
I think you posted yesterday of Brian Moore not being happy about Gascoigne poking his tongue out. That's from I'm sure that's from Gascoigne's Glory, the VHS.
Yeah, it is. It's from the video.
So as I was watching, I was going, I could almost hear like myself saying the words that Brian Moore was about to say, because I used to watch the video over and over again. Well, yeah, great clip. And Ed, where can people find you on the Twitterverse?
They can find me at Turf and Football.
He got it right.
Yeah. That's 2 weeks. That's 2 weeks in a row. I've got it right.
It's all good. If you want to follow the show at AK90s, do so, please. You can find myself at Ash Rose UK as well. We'll be back soon talking more 90s-ness. Maybe squeeze another summer topic in if we can think of one. If you've got anything you'd like us to talk about, please do. Hit us a line on Twitter. We're always open to suggestions. But until next time, this is Live and Kicking. Keep it 90s.